everyone, and welcome to Everton Business Matters, episode 14. That was Something Better Change by the Stranglers. John Blaine, your choice, I believe.
Yes, it was. I just thought it was quite apt because some things do need to change, and undoubtedly they will.
I'm sure they will. Now, I was more in favour of Bucks Fizz making your mind up. Our listeners will be delighted that I was outvoted, no doubt. Paul, can I just ask you, are you over the disappointment of losing in the quarterfinals of the Everton Twitter Crank World Cup earlier this week?
I'm still devastated, to be honest. I'm a really bad loser.
You invested a lot in it. I mean, I was in quite an easy group and was very disappointed myself to get knocked out in the group stages. John, did you feel a bit left out not to make the final 16?
Well, I didn't qualify, did I? So I've got a year of practice time, I suppose, to try and get in the 2018 event.
OK, well, we'll look forward to that. And let's just pass on our congratulations to all those who took part. And to the winner, Katie Carter. Well done, Katie. That Everton Twitter Crank World Cup at the start of the week gave us Evertonians something of a welcome distraction, I guess, from our current plight. Here we are, being pushed around by Watford, vilified by Joey Barton, called out by Phil McNulty, and our managers happy with a point once we've been dominated away to the league's bottom team. And now, to add insult to injury, our leading scorer has been banned for 2 games. What a time to be alive. Today, however, the Fun Boy Three are here to try and find some positivity, and we will leave no stone unturned. We'd like to put our thanks out there to Stephen Leary at Mr. Everton 1878 and at Bernie 063, who've given us a few questions and some ideas for today, when we intend to take a look at the transfer project which still lies within our grasp. Let us not forget we have a wealthy, largest shareholders, and one of the most exciting developments in the history of the football club is within touching distance. So I want to start with that. Bramley Moor Dock, the new stadium on the banks of the Royal Blue Mersey. Paul, where are we up to? It all gone a bit quiet, but give us some positive news if you can, please.
I'll try. I don't really know where we're up to with it, is the honest answer, because there is a complete... everything's gone quiet, and I don't think anybody at all on the fear of death is allowed to talk about it. So the usual sources, such as they may be, are saying absolutely nothing. The council is saying nothing, which from a positive point of view leads me to believe that we're pretty close to actually saying something, and that not only saying something, but something actually being shown, and there being a timetable which we can look at in the near future. There's quite a bit of, there's obviously time pressure on this. The club said in the summer that they wanted to be in the stadium for August 2021, or start of the 2021 season. If we're going to do that, there needs to be quite a lot of work done, obviously, and it has to be done very quickly. Nobody's advised any further on the timetable for that the timetable has been changed for planning permission or anything else. So early 2018 it must start.
Okay, well, John, what are your thoughts on reasons for the delay? Because there's a number of complicating factors around here, some of the engineering requirements filling in this great big dock perhaps, and some issues with UNESCO World Heritage Site. What do you understand some of those additional hurdles to be that might be causing this delay?
Yeah, I mean, agreeing with Paul, really, because you warned me you were going to ask me this. And I suppose my first response was going to be, I really don't know. Yeah, because, we were told back in January by the CEO that we would be doing a planning application this year. And as Paul has just suggested, there's nothing been said that says that's not going to happen. Of course, maybe a month later or something, we were told that the fans would be consulted at every step of the way. And then, of course, when back in July, I think it was, we got told that we'd moved forward and a principles document would be published within a couple of weeks, which all sounded pretty good at that stage, I suppose. Now, apart from those promises and the teasing that's done by Dan Meiss, I suppose, and the occasional comment from the mayor, we haven't really heard anything since. And well, not officially anyway. And I mean, you call out things like UNESCO, and it seems to me that they generally aren't happy with changes at heritage sites. And whilst I certainly don't want us to be a museum, I think that seems to be their default behaviour. But I'm reasonably confident that at the right time, you know, the City of Liverpool will deal with that. Now, as far as delays, we've no evidence there are any delays, but we have heard, haven't we, rumours that the costs are increasing, and maybe that's inevitable because the passage of time alone will tend to make costings go up. But there are specifically, I guess, those claims in some places that the cost of the site preparation, which is really what your question was alluding to, which is emptying the dock, filling the dock is included in that, and so on, is higher than expected. And when you put those things together, it suggests that the costs have increased since the numbers that were getting banded around previously by something in excess of £50 million, and that would take the overall project cost now to be something over £400 million. So that's all we know, I think.
Okay, so I'm not hearing from either of you any negativity, any doubts, any concerns that this isn't going to happen, just that the timescales are getting a little tighter. So whilst we dot the I's, cross the T's with UNESCO, whilst we are finalising the exact engineering requirements to prepare the site, Paul, could we not be getting on with some stuff? I've noticed you commenting about Chelsea and their stadium being delayed, but they still seem to be making some progress with the plans for naming rights. So do you think we could be doing some other things in parallel?
I think we could, and you know, clearly we might be, just that we don't know that we're not. Chelsea's an interesting one, and I think if you compare how Chelsea are going about it and how Tottenham, for example, went about it, Tottenham said very openly that naming rights was going to be a key part of their funding package, but that they wouldn't look for a naming rights partner until the build process has started. And the expectation for Tottenham was that by halfway through the build process, which we've now gone past, they would have a naming rights partner in place. Chelsea have taken a very different strategy, and the strategy actually I think is very clever. They've said, yes, there now appears there may be delays in the process because the process is far more complicated than we thought it was in the original planning application. But we're actually going to go out and find a naming rights partner now, if we can. And the benefit of doing that is obviously you then secure future income so you can budget more accurately than perhaps you may be able to do. But the real benefit is actually to the naming rights partner, whoever that might be, Vodafone or whomever, because they get several years free coverage. Because once the naming rights partner is in, even prior to the build starting, it's always then going to be referred to as the XYZ Stamford Bridge Stadium. And I think it's a remarkably clever strategy. And it's a strategy that, of course, that we could do. And one of the unique aspects about the banks of the River Mersey is that, you know, we've got a history of naming buildings from day one. So the Royal Liver Building has always been referred to and known as, when it was built, the Royal Liver Building, as the headquarters of the Royal Liver Assurance Company. And of course, the Cunard Building sitting next to it has always been the Cunard Building because it was their sort of global headquarters. So there's a lot of stuff that we could do, and there's a lot of positive messages that we could get out there, assuming that we have the capacity and bandwidth, whilst all of these other things are going on within the club, to do so.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that's a really good point that, you know, just because it's going to take a little bit longer and plans and construction inevitably do drag, that we could be doing more. And nobody's saying we aren't, but we're just suggesting that these are dialogues that could well be going on, because if you decide to, if you strike a naming rights deal, then you can already start referring to that partner ahead of construction, and they're getting a little bit more bang per buck. John, do you think there's more the club could also be getting on with from a commercial aspect in terms of maybe pre-selling some season tickets? Do you think they could be doing that, or is that getting a little bit cart before the horse?
Well, I think we could be doing more. And I think the thing here is, if we really believe that the stadium is going to get built, and I for one certainly do, then I don't really understand why we're not promoting it. I mean, we've just been talking about Chelsea, haven't we, as an example, and they showed artist impressions of the, you know, what the new Stamford Bridge would look like ages ago. And you know, their stadium is unlikely to be finished before 2023, which is a couple of years after, you know, we would rather hope ours would be ready and we'd be in it. And, you know, and maybe you might say that, well, Chelsea is just an artist impression. And of course, that's all that they might be at this stage, and it might change. But it would get attention, just as Chelsea do. And it would get attention from the fans, which makes it more real. From the media, of course, who would show great interest. And perhaps most relevantly, which is what Paul's talking about with what Chelsea are doing, from potential sponsors and investors. And then when you talk about fans, and the idea for me of creating a waiting list for the new stadium, or expressions of interest, as the CEO likes to refer to it, for seats, for executive boxes, for lounges and so on. I mean, not only does that give confidence in the build itself and generate some invaluable insight, I guess, about the needs of the stadium, then the thought that, yes, today we sell out Goodison Park, but we always tag on the end, that's because it's not very big. But I'm personally convinced that we'd sell out the new stadium, even when, stroke, if the capacity starts with a six. And even if the hospitality, you know, seats and lounges and things have three times or more the capacity than we have today. So if we're confident and we believe, let's show that confidence, create some excitement, and exploit the commercial benefits that would bring. And Paul's just called a reasonably innovative one out from Chelsea, which is, you know, bank the money for a naming rights well in advance, perhaps, of even when you've put a spade in the ground, never mind when the thing's finished. So I think we could and should be a bit bolder, demonstrate our confidence and that the thing will get built. And not only will it get built, it is going to be an iconic stadium and it will be full.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, isn't it? Silence is interpreted negatively. And I think we'll come on to that in part two when we talk about the managerial vacancy. But silence over the stadium, you know, I see that doubts are being expressed. People have their own concerns about the reality of it, given what's happened with the few false starts we've had in the last 5 or 10 years. So do we know, do we have any clear idea who's actually accountable? Who is heading up the project Bramley Moor on behalf of the club? Have we got external advisors in place, and who's running it from a boardroom level, Paul? Who do you understand that to be?
I would imagine, if it was me doing it anyway, it would be split into a number of different component parts. So you'd have at least one
before
person.
Before you tell me how you would like it to be, Paul, can you tell me who you think is actually running it right now?
I have no idea.
The
club could be a very short podcast.
well, the club haven't made that clear, right? Any reason why they should have done, or John, what are your thoughts? Should they have, you know, this is the job of Keith Harris is our main man. He's the go-to guy on the stadium. He'll be reporting to the chairman on a monthly basis. And should we say something like that?
Well, whenever this has been mentioned in the past, and you know, people will long recall, maybe not for this stadium on the banks of the Royal Blue Mersey, but say for Walton Hall Park or before that, the Tesco's thing, and before that, obviously, King's Dock. But in recent times, the chief exec said he spent 2 or 3 days a week on it. Yeah. So if the chief exec is spending maybe 3 days a week on a stadium project, then I think it's fair to say that he's leading it in some respect. Certainly, he's the guy who has made commitments, be it in front of the shareholders at the AGM or on a podcast with the fans forum, or indeed, you know, on TV when Sky Sports were at Finch Farm. So I think it's probably split between Robert Elston, and I just have a feeling that Keith Harris has been bringing some insight to it as well from a, you know, a process perspective, mainly, I guess, perhaps because he's really, you know, a Mashiri nominee. But in the absence of being told otherwise, we would have to assume that it's the chief exec.
Okay.
We have enough. Said, sorry, Roger, 1 second. A thought occurred to me while John was speaking. We have set up a stadium company, and I think the two directors are Robert and Denise.
Which would make sense alongside Robert. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, which would suggest that they, you know, they have the greater involvement. And given that they are the only two full-time members of the board, again, it would all lead back to them having, you know, the day-to-day responsibility to manage the project, I guess.
Yeah, we would. And from their current responsibilities, as best we can deduce them, for both Denise Barrett-Baxendale and Robert Elston, that's exactly in their remit, isn't it? Particularly Professor Baxendale, I guess, because she's accountable for, you know, customer experience, fan experience, engagement, all those sorts of things. And Robert's very much the hands-on operations director type guy. So it makes perfect sense that they would be leading the project from a project management perspective. I mean, we've seen in the media, haven't we, that some local architects and, you know, engineering firms are starting to get involved. So it could very well be ramping up under the covers. And as Paul alluded to, maybe, and in a positive sense, what we're enduring right now is the calm before the storm, and that there will be a really good reveal in the not too distant future.
So, Paul, I cut you off earlier because I just wanted to get a sense from both of you as to how you think it's being run. Let me ask you then now, Paul, how you might organise things if this were your baby.
Okay. I mean, essentially, you've got, I would imagine, three main functions. You've got the design process, you've got the financing process, and then you've got the implementation of whatever it is that you have decided to do, or whatever it is that you can afford to do, because the two may be different. So that's how I would organize internally. Somebody from the club is responsible to work with Dan Meiss on the design. Two people perhaps are responsible for going out and finding the finance. And then there's a project management team who comes together at the end in order to make sure that everything that's been planned works. And I know John probably is going to have a slightly different view from me, but that's how I would do it.
I wouldn't try and second guess me, my friend. Yeah. I agree with you whenever you're right. Yeah. It's not a problem.
Oh, okay. That's not very often. That's the problem.
But let's just remember, John does have his agenda here. He's already starting his campaign to get into the Crank World Cup next year. So we would expect you to be a lot more challenging and argumentative, John. Go right ahead.
No, I mean, you know, the nature of my day job over the last 15, 20 years would involve running large projects, yeah? Whether they're sales campaigns or what follows that when you have to go into implementation. And at some stage, which is why we talked about it on 13, I guess, you go from transition through transformation to a new target operating model and all the techie stuff that all that means. But the discipline type stuff is pretty generic, and Paul's quite right. You would have someone accountable for the finance, someone accountable in this sense for the design, and then the general project activities of the boring stuff of doing project plans and risk logs and all those sorts of things. The only thing I would add, which Paul never mentioned, was that I'd have a board level person And maybe they could only, they may be seconded onto the board for the duration of the project, but a board level person whose 100% day job is making sure that this happens. And that would be your classical special projects director. And that could be someone we brought in from outside. It could be somebody, you know, promoted, if you will, from internal, but sits at board level for the duration of the project.
Okay, so but both of you here are kind of talking about implementation. Absolutely. Well, yeah. We all want to believe that. There are still some key questions around capacity, for example. And it's all very well and good to be following a project handbook, if you will, around implementation. But are there not still a few absolutely fundamental details that have yet to be decided? Top of that list, capacity. Who and how will that decision on the capacity for the stadium be made? Paul?
Wow. I'm going to say it's going to be the finance people that will determine the capacity at the end of the day, because it's the capacity that's going to, obviously people will look at it from a cost point of view, the greater the capacity, the greater the cost. But actually I'll turn the equation around and say the capacity and the breakdown of the capacity in terms of, you know, premium seating, super premium seating and ordinary seating is going to drive the revenue model. So it's going to be down to the finance people, I think.
Do you, or John, do you share that view?
There's always more than one answer to the same question, and they can both be right, I think. Yeah. I think in a generic sense, follow the money, all roads lead back to the money. Therefore, finance emphatically will have a huge influence. I think for this particular project, and I want to say it again, so because I like hearing it, you know, for the stadium on the banks of the Royal Blue Mersey, then the first thing that comes into play is the site itself. What is possible within the confines of that site, and what other design criteria have been specified by the board that may or may not constrain the capacity? So you can imagine a project leader saying, okay, Dan, there's the site. We want everybody to be quite close to the pitch. We want to have lots of, you know, atmosphere and all those sorts of things. And what's the biggest capacity that we can have? And if the answer was 40,000, it's not going to be 60, is it? Yeah. So then you get in, let's say we get the answer back from the architect that with all the criteria that you've specified to me, you can have a 60,000 seater stadium. Then it's going to be costed, isn't it? And then the return on the investment and the paybacks and all those sorts of things come into play. And, you know, how many tiers does it have? Where are you going to put hospitality and so on? And Paul talks about this and has done on many a podcast of getting the balance right between those premium priced seats, if we call them that, and the one for the rank and file guys like us, so that we don't get runaway season ticket pricing for the 40-odd, 50,000 in the stadium who are not in premium seats. So I don't think it's binary that it's decided by the architect or it's decided by the finance guys. It's like what we say quite often between on the pitch and off the pitch and so on. You know, these things are linked and interrelated with each other. But ultimately, it's going to come down to cost. Have we got the money to build the stadium to the right standard that we want, and that fulfills the ambitions of the football club, and what does that mean the capacity will be? And I just have to believe that with all that ambition being a part of the play, it won't be less than 60,000.
Well, I think ambition's absolutely crucial, and I was just going to bring that word up there, because this is a stadium that is going to be part of our future for 50, perhaps as many as 100 years, and we have to get it right. Paul, you mentioned when we were all together on EBM 13, the potential for a Bramley Moor light. Given what is happening on the pitch and given perhaps the slowness in the project moving forward, do you think there's any danger that we may be rowing back a little on capacity and stadium expectations?
I hope not. I mean, I put the idea out there because, you know, I think that is the worst possible solution. And actually, if the thought was that the condition of the club or the condition of the finances is such that we can't build a 60,000-seat stadium, we're probably better off just parking the idea, leaving it for a few years and returning back to it at a time when the club can do it, rather than taking, you know, a short-term measure driven by short-term circumstances. I wrote some time ago, and whilst we're talking on this podcast, I just looked it up. In order to fill a 60,000-seat stadium, and I think this is really, really important, we have to sell 8,000 fewer season tickets than West Ham, 3,000 fewer executive seats than Spurs, and have 8,000 fewer walk-up supporters than Liverpool do each week. If we did that, we'd fill a 60,000-seat stadium every single week.
Yeah, and that's where you talked earlier about just flipping the equation. And that's what I'm meaning by ambition. Either we believe in this club, either we believe in the supporter base, either we believe in our ability to sell regular seating, premium seating, and super premium seating, and attract walk-up custom, or we don't. And if we believe in those things, and I'm presuming that Mr. Mashiri does, otherwise he wouldn't have invested his money in the business, then I think you're right. There has to be, you know, 60,000 has to be the absolute minimum. John, would you agree?
Absolutely. I totally and utterly agree. And I think going back to some things we frequently talk about, controlling the narrative, if this stadium, when announced, has a capacity of less than 60,000, then I'm completely and utterly expecting it to be explained by the architect that the other design criteria around atmosphere and all those sorts of things took precedence, and that's what restricted the capacity. If we restrict the capacity due to lack of confidence in our ability to fill the stadium, then that window of opportunity will have slammed shut with a very loud thud.
Thank you. Okay, thanks, John. Thanks, Paul, for that. We're just going to take a short break, blow the halftime whistle, and after the break, we're going to come back and talk about the managerial appointment, the managerial vacancy that we have at our football club right now. We'll be right back. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the second half of EBM 14. Before the break, we talked about the stadium on the banks of the Royal Blue Mersey, that wonderful project that we're all very excited about, and some of the outstanding decisions that remain to be made, particularly around capacity. Now, when we talk about decisions, I guess they don't come any bigger than selecting a new manager. And whilst that's unexpected, if we'd said at the start of the season that we'd be sat in the end of November needing a new manager, we'd have all been quite surprised. But Paul, I want to ask you, how do you think the process of finding, searching, selecting, drawing up a shortlist, how that process to find the next manager of our great football club should be handled?
I think given how serious the this next appointment is in terms of the future advancements of the club and in terms of the project, because we're broadly talking about the project this evening, it has to be the key people in the organisation that are driving the project forward have to be key parts of this process. If it's not felt that they have sufficient football experience, probably should bring in a specialist search team alongside them. I think when in the summer of 2016, although obviously Mashiri had his own views as to who should be manager then, there was a search team that was used as well. Whether there's been one used in this process or not, I don't know, but certainly it would assist the idea that perhaps there's not enough real football expertise in the board to do that.
So, John, what's your understanding of what's actually happening? I mean, Paul talked about the senior people That's Bill, Mashiri, Elstone. Who's sitting around a table drawing up a shortlist? Are they doing that? Are they acting in a joined up way? What do you sense? What do you know?
I don't know. I don't know what's going on. I doubt that very many people do know what's going on. I mean, the rumours and the comments that have come out of the media, and as you said before, which in recent times haven't been particularly complimentary, they're all just based on rumour, or maybe, I guess, some private briefing by those people who were involved. Now, Paul talked about having a specialist, you know, person or organisation or whatever. Now, to my mind, that specialist is the director of football. And as far as the director of football structure is concerned, as an example, I'm a supporter of that. That should allow for a strategic decision to be made and of course allows for continuity and those sorts of things. And certainly within the Premier League, you know, the period of tenure of a manager can be quite short. And certainly that's often shorter than the players' contracts. So what I would have expected or hoped for is that somebody is accountable for producing a short list, a recommendation, if you will, of managers who are, you know, acceptable candidates based upon a specification or a criteria that's been provided. And some clubs, you know, when we talk about Silver and Watford, but some clubs have demonstrated that changing the manager frequently shouldn't be a disaster. And we should be able to have the impact should be quite minimal as long as the overall structure of the club itself, the business, has clarity and stability. So this thing Paul said about whether there's sufficient footballing knowledge at board level, if we're talking about professional, you know, professional footballing people, the facts of life are there isn't that much at that level about footballing nouns, if you like, but there's a hell of a lot of good business experience there and people who can hopefully have opinions and make decisions. So I think I'm agreeing with Paul, really. We should have a specialist producing a short list that allows the board to select from those. And certainly when I've done recruitment in the past and I've had to pass people up the line, you know, I recommend two or three guys to my boss, knowing I don't care which one of those two or three he picks because I'm happy with all three of them. And I'd like to think that, notwithstanding whether Steve Walsh is the right guy or not, that the director of football would be the person who, him and his team, would be the person who decided on that shortlist, but the final say would clearly be made by the board, the chairman, or indeed in our case, a rather large shareholder.
Okay, there's been some suggestions in the press and, you know, various parts of the media that Everton finding it difficult to attract the candidate that they want. How important do you think it is who the people are that are trying to sell the club to the prospective candidates? Because this is obviously a two-way process. It's not just us looking for a manager, it's the manager looking at his next employment opportunity.
I think it's a very good question, and it was something that I thought might come out just before. I understand completely that we need some professionals, we need some advisors, and we need to take our time to draw up a shortlist and agree what that shortlist is and work down. There may be joint top, maybe three people that were equally, to draw your analogy, John, we'd be equally happy with any one of the three. But we must not underestimate the importance of the role of the person who is going to talk to the prospective candidate. Let's just pick one out of thin air, Carlo Ancelotti. You'll all laugh, I know. But who is it who's going to pick up the phone to Carlo, who's going to go and meet him, and who's going to try and sell the Everton vision? That person is hugely, hugely important. And in my mind, there is only one person who can do that and sell that vision of Everton Football Club 2017. It's Farhad Mashiri. He's got to go and present his case to the man who he wants to come and run his football club.
Interesting. Do you want me to comment?
I think so.
Yeah. I don't think it's one person, and I don't think it can ever be one person, but I do agree that Farhad Moshiri must be one of those. All I know is when I've been recruited at quite senior levels into businesses, I've wanted to see the people who are going to be around me, the people who are going to be peers of mine, if you will, the superiors, some of the subordinates. I want a 360-degree view, and when I do it, I often ask similar, if not the same, questions of everybody and see if I get the same answers, yeah? Because I want to understand whether the promise that I'm being given beyond money, i.e. I'm going to enjoy it, I'm going to be fulfilled, and so on, is not just the isolated vision of one individual, which turns out to be completely different when you get into the place, yeah? So if I'm going to be the new manager of Everton Football Club, yeah, I want to speak to Farhad Moshiri, but I also want to speak to Bill Kenwright. I also want to speak to Robert Elston. I probably want to speak to Steve Walsh, and I maybe and almost certainly will want to speak to David Unsworth. And then you ripple out from there. And the more people I speak to, notwithstanding we haven't got all a huge amount of time for me to do 50 interviews, but I will increase my comfort that what I got told by Moshiri and what I got told by Bill and what Robert said seem to be as a result of joined up thinking. And yes, I think I will come after all. And as we've seen, if we use Giroud as a player as an example, if you only have a one-to-one interaction, no one tests whether it's really true or not, yeah? And I think it needs to be more than one individual who's selling the club at these senior levels.
I wouldn't disagree with you, John, but another point that I think is really important here is we're talking about skills and experience, and those are going to be a vital part in the selection of the shortlist. But as with pretty much any senior appointment in any business, there are plenty of people with the skills and the experience out there. It's whether or not there's the personal chemistry. It's whether or not they feel that cultural fit that is really going to be the deciding factor. And so these people, groups of people who are selling the club to them, couldn't be more important, in my opinion. Does that answer your question, Paul?
While Paul's thinking, you know, whether that answers his question, I just want to say something back to you there, Roger, which is I wholly agree with you, totally. You know, that new manager sees all these key members. I mean, you could simplistically say he has a one-to-one meeting with each and every board member, as an example. Yeah, that yeah. might be a way to do it. Because he's doing his due diligence on us as much as we're doing it on him. And the closer we get to a common understanding from both sides of what's expected and you know, what he's going to be provided with and what we expect in return, the better. And it certainly couldn't or shouldn't be a single individual thinking, oh, Ronald Koeman's the man for me, and therefore we're having him, yeah? So I don't know if that does answer Paul's question, but I'm sure he'll tell us.
No, it does. As is always the case with me, there's a supplementary question. And do you think, given the condition that the club is in, given the people who represent the club currently, that we're in a strong enough position to attract the right long-term candidate at this point in the season, or whether or not we should actually just go, let's do a short-term fix. Let's make sure that we don't get relegated. Let's make sure that we get to the end of the season and we're in a better position next summer to attract the right candidate.
I'll take that first, if you like, sure. Paul. In a blunt sense, no. I suppose I've not seen any evidence to say that we're in the right frame of mind to attract the right candidate here and now. I'd like to think that if the board, and that includes Moshiri, I suppose, in an extended board, if they really have got their candidate and the one that they want, and they think they can get him now, then that's what they should do. Yep. If it is Silva, for example, and Watford are saying no, then you should still do the right thing. And I guess that would mean that the right thing becomes that David Unsworth runs the show to the end of the season. Because getting an interim manager in now from outside would just look so disjointed that it's not true, really, because it's gone on for so long. So the half-full version of me would like to think the reason we've had such extended period of radio silence is that the club still thinks it can get its primary candidate in now.
I'd agree. I think where we are 11, 12 games into the season, and I think I said this on EBM 13, there is no reason to...
panic. No need.
There's no need to panic. There's no reason to throw this season into the dustbin. And the danger is that if the person you appoint, let's pick a name, any name, Sean Dyche, is good enough to avoid relegation and get us to mid-table, if next year, the same time, October, we're still only 13th or 14th, what are we going to do then? We're going to sack them for being mid-table. So in my book, the project, which is what we're talking about today, is still very much ongoing. And we should be going after our number one target. We can do it quietly. We can do it discreetly. We don't want daily updates. Nobody's ever said we wanted daily updates. But I think we like to have faith that this is a continuation of the plan, not a reversal or an exercise in treading water for the next 9 months, because that's not fair. It's not fair on David Unsworth. It's not fair on an interim replacement. I think we should be going for the man who we want to manage the club for the next 3 to 5 years.
Absolutely right. And I think I would concur, and I think I've said the same as you. This is the decision we should be making is who do we want to be the manager for the next 3 to 5 years, not who do we want the manager to be for the next 6 months. Yeah. Or as you say, with the Dyche example, maybe 18 months, because it turns out, after all, he wasn't our first choice. And yeah, he apparently saved us from relegation, but actually we're still finishing 9th, 10th. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, listen, I think we're all three of us are realists as well, as being, you know, we can be a little bit pedantic, we can be a bit idealistic, and we can be perhaps at times a little bit overly critical of the club. But in the real world, do any of us really, really believe that Steve Walsh is drawing up a shortlist and has handed it to Bill? Because I, for one, do not. Paul, do you think that's actually happened? There's any chance that that's happened?
No, I don't think so. I think there would have to have been a huge power and organisational shift within the company for that to happen.
John?
No, I don't think so either. And when we talked a number of podcasts ago about the structure of the board, we said emphatically, whether it's Steve Walsh or not, that the director of football needs to sit at board level. And the reason is because presumably the board are having conversations that Steve Walsh is not a party to. Therefore, no, I can't possibly believe, as the specialist, he's got the say on what the shortlist is, and then the board make a decision. I think it's, as we all suspect, one or two guys are in regular dialogue and trying to get something over the line.
Okay, well, I want to press on this, because this is really the nitty-gritty, and I think this is probably the topic that is of most interest amongst our listeners and amongst the fan base, and it's one that causes the most discussion. It strikes me that we've got two key individuals. We've got a chairman called Bill Kenwright, and we've got a largest shareholder called Farhad Moshiri. And it strikes me that structurally, from a board perspective, as the chairman of the board, Bill holds control of that crucial decision. However, that decision needs to be approved by the man with the money. Follow the money. The man with the purse strings. That's Farhad Moshiri. How do those two come together and reach an agreement? Or is my analysis wrong, Paul?
No, I think your analysis is correct.
And we're a month in, slightly more. Now act in haste, repent at leisure. I buy that. But from what's coming out, from comments that are being made by relatively trusted, in inverted commas, journalists, we don't need to name them, but we've all seen them, there doesn't appear to be a plan, and there appears to be dissension, difference of opinion, between Bill and Farhad. John, how do you explain that? How can that actually be, that these two significant figures can have such different opinions?
Well, I'm not going to be honest, I think that's a daft question, because we're treating, or maybe you as the host, are treating layered rumour as if it's fact, yeah? And drawing a conclusion that Bill and Farhad Bashiri are at loggerheads. I mean, all I know is when I've seen them or heard them together, they seem pretty joined up. Okay, that might be a bit less formal than disagreeing over players to buy or managers to appoint or whatever. But certainly the apparent lack of a plan could simply be due to the club's apparent inability to trust in the fan base and give some at least high-level view of what we're doing. And therefore, the void of intelligence that's come from the club or communication is filled by a load of guys who have an opinion. Now, I have little doubt that some of those journalists who we've not mentioned will have got insight from perhaps Farhad Bashiri, and some of them, different ones perhaps, will have got insight from Bill Kenwright or someone close to him, and a whole host of other journalists will have no insight whatsoever. And so trying to figure out which is pure fantasy and which has got some germ of truth into it is the devil's own work. So I really don't know, and I'm not sure how anyone can know. All we know is a month after we sacked Koeman, the last formal communication from the club was, we've appointed David Unserf on an interim basis. That's it. That's the last piece of factual information we've had.
Yeah, just quickly, I'm not suggesting that Bill and Farhad are at loggerheads. What I'm suggesting is that they don't appear to be in agreement, because if they were in agreement, you might have thought we'd be further down the line than we are right now, because there is persistent confusion over David Unserf and his role. And he's making, you know, sort of conflicting statements at his different press conferences. That's not rumour. That's what he's saying.
Paul, whoa. I mean, what conflicting statements has David made? I mean, clearly, a part of the communication or lack of communication from the club means that every Wednesday or Thursday, depending on, you know, when we're playing games and stuff, maybe a Friday, David Unserf gets asked the same question, and he gets asked about the manager. I think today he said no further updates or something, didn't he? So he's, to my mind, and we can all do some deduction, but that doesn't make it fact. So my deduction is he knows little more than we do and is almost managing on a game-by-game basis. And if that's the case, that's a real issue, because the players know that it's game-by-game as well. For all we know, Farhad Bashiri and Bill Kenwright and the rest of the board are totally joined up. They know who their primary target is. It's been the same guy for the last 4 weeks, and they're working to get that to happen. That's about as credible as all the other rumours we've heard, isn't it?
I know, but I feel so sorry for Rhino, because, you know, all he needs to be given is something that he can say quite sensibly at every press conference, which is, listen, guys, I'm the interim manager. I've got the complete backing of the board, and I'm in charge for the foreseeable future. They're doing what they're doing, and I'm concentrating on the first team, and I'll be here for as long as it takes. And
that, absolutely, you know, right. Absolutely,
I think there's been
right.
A real change over the games that he's had in charge. He's gone from believing and talking as if he were a real candidate for the job on a full-time basis to acknowledging that he's just there filling in a gap. And I think that whole uncertainty and lack of clarity in communication is not his fault. Somebody who's responsible for communication at the football club is letting him down. And I'd love to know who is. Nobody there seems to have the capability to make a clear statement. We're taking our time. It's an important appointment. We're going through a proper process, and David's got our confidence until such time as we find a suitable replacement. It's quite simple. It's quite clear. All the rumours go away, and the fans are quite happy. But at the moment, this uncertainty, this persistence in silence, I'm sorry, I just don't think it's acceptable, and I don't think it's fair to David Unsworth.
I agree with all that. You know, I do, because I took a bit of stick for my version of what would have killed a lot of this speculation a number of weeks ago, which is where we get into that basically the binary view of, if there's nothing to say, keep your mouth shut, versus, you know, say enough to make people know that you are engaged, you are doing things, and you have, you know, you will sort this. Sorry, Paul, I cut across.
No, it's okay. I think I wanted to make two points. I think
it's always two.
It could be many more. I keep trying to keep it brief for you guys. I think David's just been hung out to dry, and I think, you know, from an employee, as an employer, the club have been very unfair to him. I think he needed support on the first day, the first press conference that he did when he'd been appointed as interim manager. He needed, you know, a senior member of the club to sit alongside him and say, David is our choice for the time being. We're looking at other candidates. Whatever the message was, he needed somebody to be there. And he's not been supported in any way since by anything that the club has said, as we've just spoken about for the last 10 minutes. From a business perspective, I think what's critical about keeping people informed is that there are partners out there who are possibly wondering what's happening in the club. But more importantly, given where we are in terms of Everton's own business cycle, is there are going to be prospective business partners sitting there looking at, maybe they're considering doing some business with Everton, being a sponsor, being a commercial partner, whatever. And they may just be thinking, you know what, when things get difficult, this organization doesn't really react in a professional and assertive way. It disappears. And do we want to lend our brand and our brand values to an organization that behaves in that way when there are difficulties? And I think that, to me, and I accept that this is possibly a rather obscure view, I actually think that is one of the most damaging aspects of all of this.
I couldn't agree more. I think communication by silence is just negligent. And David has needed somebody by him. It doesn't have to have been Bill. It didn't have to be Farhad. But surely, you know, talking about business here, let's just take the football out of it. Surely the most obvious person to come out and sit and face the media and explain what's happened would be the chief executive. Surely the chief executive should come out at that first press conference and say, right, here's David Unsworth. He's the interim manager. I mean, I'll tell you a funny story. I get the Everton magazine. It arrived through the letterbox yesterday. Absolutely no mention in that about the fact that we sacked Ronald Koeman. It's all kind of la-la happy land. And here's the new manager, and he's called David Unsworth. You just cannot treat the fans like fools. You've got to give support to Unsworth, support to the man who's decided to fill in the gap whilst they find a suitable replacement. And for the chief executive of the business not to be able to come out and stand shoulder to shoulder with him, I think is really, really poor. Communication by silence, it just doesn't work for me. And yeah. I don't buy this. Everything's okay in the background. You know, you don't want, you know, we don't need daily updates. You've got to come out at the start of the process and say what's going on, just what the plan is and what your priorities are and what the timescales are. Silence, it just leads to panic and confusion and leads others to manage the narrative.
And it's, but I know it's boring, Roger, but we've been saying this for 6 months now about control. You just said it at the end then, controlling the narrative. You know, you get your message out there early, you get it right, and you stay consistent to it. And then a lot of this noise goes away. I mean, it doesn't stop journalists asking questions, but it gives David, or if his board member, sort of bagman, if you will, is the chief exec, or maybe even the deputy chief exec or the chairman. I mean, there's three roles for one job by the sounds of it to me. But one of those people, you know, could have been there with him, and he's got his stock response. You know, he can say, listen, guys, you keep asking me the same question. The answer's not going to change. I'm the manager until the board lands their target. And between now and then, I have their full support. And as you're implying, aren't you, Roger, Robert or Denise or Bill or somebody is sat next to him nodding and saying, absolutely, that's exactly what's happening. And but the longer this goes on now, and the more it festers, the more people, media probably out there, get the confidence to say things which may or may not be true because they know they're not going to get a kickback from our football club.
Yeah, I mean, look, do you think any of our peer group or the peer group that we aspire to, Tottenham,
no,
Arsenal,
they wouldn't. No,
City,
they
United, Chelsea, Liverpool, would allow this? I mean, all of those chief executives or chairman would have come out on day one, sat there with the interim manager, would have explained why Koeman had been relieved of his duties, and would have put the media, let's say, in their place, would have come out and controlled the agenda. I think it's absolutely reprehensible the way David Unsworth's been hung out to dry. I really do. Paul, any other thoughts from you in terms of timescales? Because, you know, we don't need to rush, but games are going by. The January window's getting closer. When do you think they want to, and when do you think they should have made an appointment?
Well, the easy answer is that they should have already made the appointment, because there should have been some preparation. Unless, of course, the decision to lose the last manager was just, you know, a sort of fairly instantaneous reaction to the Arsenal defeat. I can't believe that it was, but you know, it's possible that it could have been. I didn't see or hear the press conference today. I thought I heard that there was a comment about from David that he'd been discussing January transfer window
with Steve
personnel.
Walsh.
Yeah, with Steve Walsh. Walsh. Which sort of suggests that perhaps nobody's that confident that there's going to be a very quick resolution.
It could do, but again, we're second guessing. It could be that Steve Walsh talks to the manager about transfer targets, and David's the man in the seat at the moment. And that's why these things, going back to what Roger was asking about directors of football and things, if Steve should be the continuity, shouldn't he? Oh, sorry, the role he fulfills, the director of football should be the continuity man. He's here for 10 years or more, and he might go through two or three managers in that time, but we get continuity. So his day job should carry on, no matter whose name is on the manager's office door.
Exactly. And the great irony of this, of course, is that Watford are probably the one football club in the Premier League that have that organisational capability to continue, regardless of, as you say, who's the top coach.
Yeah, it's a good point. Listen, let me just ask both of you a question, because we've talked about this several times before. And we've mentioned it today that Bill's there as the chairman of the board, and as such really carries primary accountability for the appointment of a new manager, and yet Farhad is holding the purse strings. And God forbid they were to disagree. How does that get resolved? How does one win, in inverted commas, over the other? And is there anything within the shareholder agreement that you, either of you, might be aware of or might speculate on even, that could bring us to a process where there clearly was one decision maker and who had control over both the board and the purse strings? Anything that you can enlighten us on there, gentlemen, before we wrap up?
I'll pick that one up if you like, Roger, because I guess the first thing is a bit like I said before, you know, no one will really know if there are any restrictions inside, you know, the shareholders agreements and what have you, the sale of shares, the sale agreement and stuff. But I just keep coming back to the same boring answer, really. Our football club is run by the board, and the chairman of the board is Bill Kenwright, and there's five board members, and they make the decisions. Now, inside the board, they can influence each other, and external to the board can influence board members, but ultimately, the board makes the decision, and they are held accountable to it. Now, your question really is, if the board makes a decision that says X and Farhad Moshiri wants it to be Y, or certainly not X, what happens? I can't see how he could do anything other than explain how disappointed he is that he can't convince people to do what he wants. But if he insisted on getting his own way because he's the largest shareholder, then it would be a whites of the eyes thing, I guess, between Farhad Moshiri, John Woods and Bill Kenwright, as to whether to really wash our dirty linen in public and have a general meeting to talk about it and see what the rest of the shareholders thought.
Paul, what are your thoughts?
That's a very interesting idea, John.
It's never going to happen, mind.
Oh, dear. My thoughts are that probably Farhad's, the way that he would go about it, so the board decides X and he's dead against X or doesn't want X, is that he would pick up the phone, or if he was present with other directors, he would say, I think you've made the wrong decision and I think you have to go back and make a different decision, or you have to have another board meeting and reach a different conclusion. Both the same things, really. I've seen it be handled like that in many organizations where there is a major shareholder, not a majority shareholder, who doesn't sit on the board, not happy with the decision, tells you to go back and make the decision again effectively.
Yeah, I agree with that, Paul. The way I took Roger's question was, you've gone through that loop either once or on multiple occasions.
Yep.
The board have dropped anchor, if you will, on this is our decision, and Moshiri doesn't like it. That's why I answered it the way I answered it.
He
would have to force the issue then in a way that could get really messy, and I just can't imagine he would ever do that. But he clearly wouldn't be getting what he wanted. And that actually, the thing that it might stimulate is him exercising control and getting 50-point-something%.
Yeah, I think
that's really also what I was alluding to. Could there be a point here? Could this be a tipping point whereby if the disagreement is such and the relative intransigence of the two principal participants is so great, could we see an acceleration of share purchases by Moshiri in order to get that maximum control, that majority voting control over the board?
That depends upon the conditions within the options agreement. Personally, I don't think it's possible for him to do that. I think there'll either be a time condition, for example, 2 years, or there'll be a condition in terms of getting planning permission for the stadium and financing for the stadium before he can trigger his options. So I don't think he can do very much about it at all. If he wanted to gain majority control, he could just go out and buy a couple of hundred shares from various shareholders who I'm sure would be happy to sell to him. He wouldn't have to go through the options arrangement.
That's true, actually. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know, he's 65 shares short. 35 shares short of having majority. So if he goes out and buys 50 shares, he's got effective majority anyway.
And maybe, Paul, what we're really saying in practical terms, just being able to explain to the board, which isn't doing as it's told, or rather not coming up with the right answer, as Mr. Moshiri sees it, explaining it the way you just did then means they'd probably go with what he said, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Yeah, which is how it happens, you know. Across the world, where you've got, a very near majority investor. From a positive perspective, I don't think we're at that stage. Although we don't know, but I don't think we're at that stage. But obviously, it's interesting to talk about how it would occur if we were at that stage.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much. We've come to the end of EBM 14. It's been another fascinating hour and a bit. Thank you both, Paul and John, for your contributions. Here on Everton Business Matters, we've been saying for over 6 months that what happens off the pitch has a significant impact on events on the pitch. Little did we know how true that might prove to be. In business and in a brand-centric consumer business like Everton, perceptions are everything. And perceptions are other people's reality. Therefore, whether it's true or not, this perception of division, of confusion, of indecision at the very top of our football club is having a real negative impact on fans, on players, on staff, not just current players, but potential players and potential members of staff. Similarly with partners, as John's alluded to, current and potential. And it can have a really negative impact on media relations. The longer this perception exists and the club does nothing to address it through words and actions, the worse the outcome will become. We are in real danger of becoming a laughingstock. And that can only be addressed by clear, confident and decisive leadership, which has to involve a proper changing of the guard at Everton, with people who are committed to the motto that is our standard, nil satis, nisi optimum. Now, at the start of the show, we promised positivity. And if NSNO is not a positive force for good and a positive force for change, then we might as well all go home. Because it ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. That's what gets results. Until the next time, up the Toffees.